Now it's time to begin the seminar. I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Cindy for introductions. Cindy.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks, everyone, for joining us today. I just want to give you a quick heads up that you can find more information about the Federal Remediation Technologies Roundtable at frtr.gov. There we have information about the November 2023 meeting, which is where these talks came from. And also, you'll find information about the upcoming FRTR meeting that will be held in May in the DC area. So the FRTR is a collaborative effort between federal cleanup program managers and other remediation community representatives. You can find information about which agencies are members and what FRTR's goals are on that frtr.gov website. Also, I'll mention that these in-person meetings that we hold twice a year, those are also open to the public. So folks are welcome to join. We usually hold them in the DC area. This last one was at the USGS headquarters in Reston. Our upcoming May 1 will be held at EPA headquarters in DC. So we look forward to seeing you there in person, or you can join us by webinar also. So in November's meeting, we had some audio issues early in the day that made it kind of difficult for online participants to hear these presentations. So we've invited these presenters to come back and deliver this information again, just to make sure that it's available for folks to view online. So if you did catch the November talk, you might notice today that there is also some updated information for you. I mentioned we've got our next meeting coming up May 21st. The registration's not open for that yet, but you'll be able to find information about that upcoming meeting on frtr.gov. So let me first introduce our first speaker here. We have Dr. Nicolette Andrzejczyk. She's an environmental technologist at NAVFAC Exwick. Nikki, I might ask you to explain that acronym because I don't remember what all the initials are. But
yeah, it's the Naval Facilities Engineering Expeditionary Warfare Center.
Thank you, Nikki. So Nikki's research experience spans all sorts of contaminant groups, last but not least, PFAS. And of course, she's involved in various PFAS-related projects for the Navy and provides technical consultation on projects there. Prior to joining NAVFAC Exwick, she completed her PhD at UC Riverside. And with that, I will go ahead and turn it over to Nikki. Thank you, Nikki.
Thank you. Let me just get my slides up here. All right, how does that look?
Looks great, thanks.
Okay, great. Yeah, so my name is Nicolette Andrzejczyk. I'm with NAVFAC Exwick, and today I'll be presenting on best practices for PFAS sampling and analysis. So before we get started, just a quick disclaimer, just to summarize, this essentially says that any technologies or products that are included in this webinar aren't indicative of any type of endorsement by the DoD or by NAVFAC Exwick. So getting into our presentation overview, so we'll start with just a brief introduction, spend some time talking about how to avoid cross-contamination during sampling, some field sampling considerations for different types of environmental media, then briefly touch upon some analytical best practices, and then wrap that presentation. Okay, so just a brief introduction. So PFAS are used in a wide array of different products. So here in this figure on the right, you can see that PFAS are included in a whole range of different consumer products. So nonstick cookware, firefighting foam, any type of stain-resistant products, water-resistant clothing, the list goes on. And so, you know, when we're sampling, this causes a pretty significant potential for cross-contamination compared to some other products that might be used to sampling for. And so when we're sampling, it's critical that we ensure that we are preventing cross-contamination as much as we can to ensure our sample integrity and ultimately produce defensible data that support sound decision making. So for PFAS, this is especially important since we're seeing kind of a trend of decreasing screening and action levels. So for example, the most recent US EPA MCLs, four parts per trillion for PFAS and PFOA. So as we see these types of screening and action levels and different types of regulatory levels decrease, we want to make sure that we're not introducing any form of bias from our sampling. I also just wanted to make everyone aware of some existing PFAS sampling guidelines. So there's a host of various federal and state guidelines. So for federal, NAFVAC has some, the DoD Environmental Data Quality Work Group, or the EDQW, and of course the EPA. And there's a whole number of different states that have their own sampling guidelines as well. So the one that I'll point out is the Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes and Energy, EGLE. They have some really great sampling guidelines. So when you are developing your sampling work plan, it's really important that you consider your specific agency or state sampling guidelines. Today I'll be talking about some general sampling guidelines, but at the end of the day, you should always double check that you're following your state or your agency and state sampling guidance. And of course, the presentation today isn't all-encompassing, so I think we would need a presentation for a few hours to get all of that information in there. So for anything that I don't touch upon, these are really great resources to check into. Okay, so with that, we'll go into some ways to avoid cross-contamination during sampling. So again, in order to produce defensible data, it's really important that our samples aren't compromised by PFAS that could be coming from our sampling equipment. So for things like soaps, for example, that could be used in decontamination of equipment, it's really important to review your safety data sheets or SDS prior to actually using at your site. So of course, you can look for PFAS specifically in those SDS files.
Mickey, I don't. Oh, there we are. Your audio cut out for a moment.
Oh, sorry about that. Is it working all right now?
Sounds good.
Okay, sorry about that. I also have some example materials that could introduce PFAS into a sample. So PTFE, waterproof coatings, LDPE. So just make sure that when you're preparing your sampling plan, that these materials are avoided as much as possible. And within your work plan, you should also document those materials that you plan to exclude due to PFAS content. You could also consider including an ultra clean sample handling protocol. So one of the more common ones is the Clean Hands, Dirty Hands protocol. This is often used for trace metal analyses. So in this protocol, essentially, one person is the clean hands person, so that's the only person that's actually touching the sample bottle, and then the dirty hands person touches all the other sampling materials. So this is a really effective technique since only one person will be touching the sample bottle with clean hands, so therefore reducing any potential for cross-contamination. I wanted to touch upon some materials that are commonly prohibited within various sampling guidelines. Teflon is a big one. We've heard a lot about Teflon. LDPE containing materials, so bags and as well as containers or sample bottles. Markers, for example, chemical ice packs, decontamination soap. So some of them have fluorosurfactants. So it's important that when you're developing your sampling plan to make sure that your Decon soap doesn't contain those fluorosurfactants. Of course, some waterproof, water-resistant clothing, such as Gore-Tex and Tyvek. So these are all commonly prohibited or equipment that's said to be avoided during sampling. I guess one note I wanted to add here. So typically, for example, for Teflon, the the major concern when PFAS was first becoming a bigger issue is that Teflon could potentially cause a positive bias or introduce PFAS into your sample. But I know that there's been some recent studies done that have shown that Teflon can actually store PFAS to itself and therefore introduce a negative bias in your sample. So it really could go either way. On the other hand, there's also some commonly recommended materials and equipment. So instead of those LDPE materials using HDPE and silicone, nitrile gloves, just make sure to change those often. Instead of markers, use the pens. Instead of the blue ice packs, use of bags of ice. And of course, there's some decontamination soaps such as Alkinox or Liquinox that don't contain those fluoro surfactants. I also wanted to back up the previous two slides with some data. So this is a study by Redova et al. 2020. This was a project that was funded by the DoD CERTA research program. And I've put the citation here at the bottom if you'd like to read this this article. So essentially within this study, they analyzed 66 materials that were commonly used in sampling protocols for 52 PFAS, as well as through PGI, which essentially quantifies the fluorine in your materials. So you can see some of the examples here in this chart. So things like first aid patching, different types of tapes, your lab papers, markers, things of that nature. So 22 materials out of those 66 actually had no quantifiable PFAS concentrations. 10 materials had quantifiable concentrations of those target PFAS, and 15 had total fluorine detects. So I thought this was a really interesting study because it actually gives us scientific evidence of how much PFAS we're actually seeing in these items and whether or not it makes sense to include or exclude some of these items in our PFAS sampling protocols. So some interesting ones. So for example, the marker, I think this had the highest detect of PFAS. So you could see at PFOA 83 micrograms per meter square. So some of these actually had quite high concentrations of those target PFAS. So if you're interested in this, I recommend taking a look at the paper. This is just the subsection of the data that was there, but for the full data, you can get that there. I thought it was a pretty well done study with good implications on our sampling protocols. An additional study by Jennifer Fields et al. In 2021, this was also a CERTA project. So this study looked at the actual potential pathways for PFAS to enter a sample. So although you can have sampling materials that contain PFAS, at the end of the day, you're going to need a complete pathway for PFAS to actually enter that sample. So the first pathway that was identified, the direct sample contact with sampling equipment. So this is the most likely pathway for introducing PFAS into a sample. So this really centers around your sample containers, things like tubing, pump components, your balers, sleeves and liners, so anything that's going to come into direct contact with the media that you're sampling. The second pathway is incidental contamination while the sample bottle is open. So the idea here is that theoretically you could have cross-contamination occur when your sample bottle is open. So this includes things like entry via dust and soil particles, if you have volatile PFAS, or even something for example, some sunscreen entering your sample bottle somehow, if someone's applying it near you, just like theoretical various scenarios like that. But to put it into perspective, you would need approximately 0.5 nanograms of PFAS to enter your sample bottle of 250 milliliters to exceed reporting concentrations. And then to put that into perspective, that's equivalent to about 1 to 2 drops of sunscreen entering a bottle. So you would need a pretty high mass of your PFAS to accidentally enter your sample bottle. And so this is fairly unlikely to occur, especially if you are following standard sampling protocols. So this pathway is not as much of a concern. And then finally, the last pathway that they identified was contamination during shipping. So typically, guidance documents will provide restrictions regarding your sample packaging, and even the method that you're using. Some methods require the use of HDPE containers. So if you're following those guidelines, that there's really no plausible way for non-volatile PFAS to enter your sample bottle from these materials. So the takeaway point from this slide is that there's a low potential for cross-contamination from sampling materials that aren't coming into direct contact with the sample. And so based on this data, greater focus should be placed on those equipment and materials that come into direct contact with your sample. At the end of the day, it might not be reasonable to exclude everything from your sampling just because it contains PFAS, but it might be more reasonable to use the data that's available from the previous study and this study to kind of use scientific judgment to really narrow down which materials we really should be focusing on to be PFAS free. So here's just some additional data from the same study, Field et al. So again, this just shows some common materials, equipment, and products, as well as if they have potential for direct contact with the sample, if there is really no potential pathway for that material or product to affect the sample if you're following your standard field protocols. So, for example, like waterproof outdoor clothing, oftentimes sampling guidelines will recommend to avoid use of Gore-Tex and similar materials. But this study, Field et al., showed that if you're following your standard field protocols, wearing Gore-Tex shouldn't be much of an issue, again, if you are adhering to those protocols. So I guess the key point from these past few slides is that you should really consider a scientifically informed approach for selecting your sampling materials, one, based on the probability of direct contact with the sample, and then two, the relative PFAS concentrations within that material. So for example, if an ice pack has relatively very low concentration of PFAS and it's not coming into direct contact with the sample, realistically, they're likely isn't much of a concern for introduction of PFAS through that pathway. So just some things to consider, because again, it might not be realistic to exclude every single thing that might have, small amounts of PFAS within your sampling protocol. Also important to consider is your equipment decontamination. So it's important to make sure that your equipment is decontaminated before mobilization to each investigation area and then between sample locations to prevent any carryover of PFAS on your equipment. I've already mentioned this before, but again, it's important to review those SDS files and ensure that the detergents or soaps that you're using don't contain fluorosurfactants. Aside from fluorosurfactants, your equipment should also be rinsed with laboratory verified PFAS-free water immediately before use. And this is especially important, again, for that equipment that's coming into direct contact with your sample, things like augers, things of that nature. For larger equipment, you can use potable water for decontamination. It's just important to make sure that either during your work plan development and especially before your field mobilization, that those potable water sources are verified to be PFAS free. So for the Navy, for example, we use a threshold cutoff. So for example, if the concentrations exceed RSLs based on a hazard quotient of 0.1, then we use another source of water. So just making sure that it's as, PFAS free as possible. And then also including a source and equipment blank in your work plan. So, if you do have some low trace levels of PFAS throughout your samples, you could then go back to your source and equipment blanks and deduce whether it could be from either of those sources. So just to wrap up this section, so some key points. So again, avoid equipment most likely to bias results. So Of course, this is most important for those materials that are coming into direct contact with your sample. So things like sample containers. Make sure to use field best practices. So changing gloves and collecting your field and source water blanks. Very important to decontaminate your sampling equipment. So whether that's using your decontamination soaps as well as your laboratory certified PFAS-free water. And then finally, again, just consider if a plausible pathway exists. Again, using that scientifically informed decision-making process to see whether there actually is a complete pathway for that material to impact your sample. Okay, so now we'll go into the field sampling considerations. So the way that I've broken this up is by media. So the first media I'll talk about is groundwater. So in general, low flow or passive sampling techniques are preferred in order to minimize turbidity of your samples, as well as to reduce purge water volume. So here on the right side, just the figure of well sampling. So you can see that when you have that low flow sampling, it minimizes your drawdown and therefore your turbidity and purge volume. And it's important to have low turbidity samples to reduce any potential bias within your sample. And of course, use of these low flow sampling methods is preferred for collecting definitive data for use in risk assessments as well as for your site management decisions. Another thing to consider is your sample depth selection. So when you're selecting your sample depths, there are kind of some key points to keep in mind. So stratification of PFAS within your aquifer, phase partitioning, and then finally accumulation of PFAS at the air-water interface. In terms of turbidity, samples should not be filtered due to absorption of PFAS to the filter. This is also why it's really important to minimize turbidity while you're doing the actual sampling. So for some analytical methods, centrifuging is okay. So for example, for method 1633, filtering isn't allowed, but samples can be centrifuged if absolutely necessary. For your sample location selection, you should also keep in mind the potential impact of runoff and stormwater conveyance systems. So, after rainfall, you often see spikes of your contaminant of interest in that stormwater runoff as well as groundwater. So, if you're aware of where those runoff channels are, then you can better place your sampling location wells and have a better understanding of your conceptual site model. Environmental sequence stratigraphy can be helpful for placing wells since it can help you deduce where there's evidence of those geological preferential pathways. Also, when you're collecting groundwater, some additional data could be important to help you understand your conceptual site model. So more specifically, help you understand the migration and transformation potential. So things like dissolved oxygen, oxidation reduction potential, pH, your common anions, cations, those all will affect, potential migration as well as transformation in groundwater. So if you have a good understanding of those components as well, you can have a better understanding of your site, overall. I also wanted to touch upon some well construction key points to consider within this section. So when you're constructing wells, it's important that you avoid shrink and crack resistant concrete formulations when you're building these well pads. Those often contain fluorinated surfactants. So again, just check the SDS or check with the manufacturer to ensure that those compounds aren't present within those concrete formulations. You should also avoid grease and thread compounds that contain fluorinated chemicals. So, for example, on the right, this is a commonly used threading compound, but it does contain Teflon. So, really important again to check the SDS files to double check what is actually in those grease and thread compounds. Your purging and sampling equipment may contain PFAS, so important that you check with your equipment vendor to see if they are aware of PFAS content or if there are PFAS-free alternatives available. Then finally here, coated bentonite formulations. Those are used for bridging wells after development. Those should be avoided as much as possible due to potential for leaching of PFAS. And I do have a separate slide here on bentonite. So this is a study that Nafek, Exwick, Jacobs, and Battelle did. So preliminary study, various types of bentonite pellets were leached for 24 hours. And that the leachate for coated bentonite pellets contained various types of PFAS. And it contained PFAS at higher concentrations than the control as well as uncoated pellets. The triple coated bentonite pellets had roughly triple the concentration of that contained in the single coated pellets, which supported the idea that the pellet coating was likely the source of PFAS. More recently, Nafek Exwick completed an additional study, so some additional leaching studies using bentonite pellets from multiple vendors. And this time we used three different types of groundwater and looked at different three different time points. So some preliminary data from this study indicate the presence of fluorinated organic compounds in the coated bentonite pellets. So the key point here is that the use of coated bentonite pellets during well insulation does present a potential for low-level false positives. And therefore, it's recommended that coated bentonite pellets are avoided during insulation of wells for sites for PFAS evaluation. And we're currently finalizing this report, so all of the data will be available sometime soon. Okay, so moving into surface water and sediments. So in general, surface water samples should be collected first, so prior to your sediment samples, and that's essentially to avoid introduction of particulates into your sample. So you can imagine if you go and sample your sediment sample, that's going to agitate, the sediment and introduce turbidity into your water column. So if you can collect your surface water sample first, that removes the issue of the turbidity introduction. For flowing water bodies like streams and rivers, you should sample downstream to upstream. Again, it's the same thing to avoid introduction of turbidity into your sample. And also important to sample during base flow conditions, so not during or within 48 hours after your storm event. And it's also important to consider your sample depth. So sample location in the water column should consider the potential stratification of PFAS in solution. So essentially, your surface water depth interval sampling is really going to depend on your data quality objectives that you establish for your project. So typically for like an ecological risk assessment, you would collect samples within the water column. However, there are times when it could be useful to sample at the air-water interface. So for example, if you're interested in some type of a treatment planning and want to collect the most concentrated water, then that could be from the air-water interface. I guess another thing to mention here is foam. So PFAS is known to accumulate in foam on the at the top of the water column. So that's something to consider that could be important, for example, for some type of a human health receptor, like a recreational receptor. So just something to also keep in mind. So kind of tailing off of the sediment surface water, I also wanted to briefly talk about the use of passive samplers for PFAS. So these are small, durable samplers that measure the bioavailable levels of PFAS in either sediment, groundwater, or surface water. And they're typically deployed for 2 to 4 weeks until the sampler reaches equilibrium with whatever you're sampling. Essentially, PFAS diffuses across the membrane into the sample bottle again until it reaches equilibrium. And so currently, there's a few DoD ESTCP research projects going on to develop these passive samplers for PFAS specifically. So these are well developed for some other contaminants of interest, but currently being developed for PFAS as well. So just give a rundown. So these are, again, small containers capped with a semi-permeable membrane. Oftentimes they'll have this protective outer cap with open permeations to allow water to get in. And they're filled with PFAS-free, ultra-pure water. Then, for example, if you're interested in sampling pore water, they're inserted into the sediment. And then the solution in the sampler equilibrates, or sorry, the solution in the sampler equilibrates with the dissolved PFAS in your sediments. And then you're able to get the bioavailable concentration of PFAS within that pore water. So some benefits of passive samplers. So main ones include limiting the problem of purge water disposal. Again, might reduce or eliminate turbidity compared to pump samples. And then it tends to be pretty cost effective, the use of these passive samplers. Okay, so moving into soil now. So the main consideration with soil is to consider the different soil horizons. To assess concentration strata and migration, as well as your vertical extent of your impacts. So here on the right, in this figure, I think this shows this concept pretty well. So you have your soil horizons. This figure here in the middle shows the lithology, so your relative composition of clay, sand, and silts. And then finally, this last figure shows the PFAS mass throughout the soil column. So you can see that your PFAS concentrations vary throughout your depth. And so it's really important to get an idea of how that varies throughout your soil, as well as the maximum extent throughout your soil column. One thing I'll point out, for example, in the lithology, you can see that at about 0.5 meters that you see a pretty significant clay layer. And in the PFAS mass, you could see that that correlates to most of the PFAS being retained within that clay layer. So being aware of, you know, your lithology and how that may impact where your PFAS are retained within the soil column is important, and it will allow you to understand your site better. So delineation should also consider the extent of PFAS that pose an acceptable risk from direct exposure to soil. You should also consider the extent of PFAS that can leach from soil into your groundwater at levels of concern. And then finally, similar to groundwater, collecting some concurrent data such as total organic carbon, pH, total oxygen demand, your anion-cation exchange capacity, all of that information will again help you understand the potential for desorption, transformation, migration, things of that nature. So that's especially a good example of this is the clay layers, for example. So those have a high anion exchange capacity. So we often see a lot of our PFAS mass being retained within those clay layers. Okay, so moving on to biota. So biota sampling should really only be considered if one, there is a confirmed PFAS release to some abiotic media, and then two, there is a complete pathway for biota exposure from that media. If you do go on to do biota sampling, the species of fish collected, as well as the portion of fish sampled, depends on your project goals. So obviously, it's going to differ if you're doing a human health risk assessment versus an ecological risk assessment. And then the portion of the fish sampled, so you know, the whole fish versus fillet, that can vary between various communities. So just important to keep those technical considerations in mind. Before or during your work plan development, you can also consider previous aquatic biota sampling that's been performed by any local agencies and see if there's any data that you can leverage there. It's also important to conduct a site survey to determine what fish and shellfish are present, and as well as if those can be collected. So I've heard of some examples where, shellfish sampling was needed, and they went out and they weren't actually able to get enough biomass to complete the analyses. So it's really important to just get a baseline understanding of how much samples can be co collected and if that's adequate for sample analysis. Then finally, you should consider including the use of standard reference materials to add to the QA/QC of your sampling. So I'll talk about air briefly. So something that's not on this slide, in November 2023, EPA released a report from two sites indicating that the vapor intrusion pathway should be considered within CERCLA and other types of investigations. So the reports show that there is a potential for if you have PFAS in the subsurface soil or groundwater, there is potential for that gas to potentially expose or cause exposure through the vapor intrusion pathway. So right now there's more research being done in this area. There's currently two US EPA other test methods or OTMs for measuring PFAS source emissions. So this first one, OTM 45, this focuses on semi-volatile, non-volatile polar PFAS. And then recently, actually just in January, the EPA released their draft method OTM 50. This is for polar volatile PFAS. I also wanted to just briefly mention that these OTMs are not promulgated. So instead, these promote consistency with what the EPA believes is the current best practice for sampling and analysis. I also wanted to briefly talk about considering background PFAS. So I won't go through each of these studies, but essentially there's been many studies in the past few years that have come out that have identified that within all types of media, so groundwater, surface water, soil, and precipitation, all types of various PFAS compounds can be found at background levels from either atmospheric transport or rainwater transport. And this was found basically in all regions of the world that were tested, including areas that are far removed from any potential PFAS sources. So what this indicates is that atmospheric and rainwater transport can contribute background levels of PFAS at your site in various types of media. So it's really important to consider when you are doing your site investigation. And again, this is going to be even more important given low parts per trillion screening and action levels. PFAS background levels can then play a big part when we're dealing with these low parts per trillion regulatory levels. So it's important to consider PFAS background levels to generate data that supports defensible project decisions as well as acceptable final remedies. And if you're interested in PFAS background levels, these articles that I have here, these are really interesting. So suggest that you take a look at these. And the full citations are at the end of this presentation. Okay, now I will briefly go into some analytical best practices. The presentation after me will kind of go into these in more depth, so I'll kind of keep it brief for this section. So this is just an overview of PFAS analytical methods that are currently being used. So US EPA method 537.1 and US EPA method 533, those are the main drinking water methods that are used. Both are multi-laboratory validated. More recently, the EPA released its final method 1633. So that one is actually multi-laboratory validated. So there should be an X here. So this slide was from the fall meeting before the final was released. So apologies for that. And this is for matrices, essentially anything other than drinking water. So surface water, wastewater, groundwater, biota, sediment, so on and so forth. There also are some AFFF methods for firefighting foam, and again, the two EPA OTM methods for air. I've included some general considerations that relate to sampling and analysis. So your sample containers, those recommendations are going to be dependent on which analytical method you're using. So, for example, US EPA method 1633, that uses the high density polyethylene containers as opposed to methods 533 and 537.1, which use different materials. And so oftentimes these bottles or sample containers are actually provided by the laboratory and should be laboratory verified PFAS free. So this typically isn't much of an issue. It's also important to keep in mind that which method you're using will have specific guidelines in terms of your sample preservation, shipping times, storage requirements, as well as your holding time requirements. So it's really important that after you do your sampling of your sample, that you adhere to the method-specific protocols that are laid out for your method. It's also important to work closely with the laboratory to ensure that your samples generate data that meet project objectives. So the key point here, again, ensure to follow all of the QA/QC requirements during sampling and for your sample shipment. And again, that's specific to which analytical method that you're using. So you can work closely with your laboratory to make sure that you are adhering to all these requirements. So I won't go into this in detail, but it's here if you're interested. Again, these slides will be posted on the website, so you can download them from there. But it's important that you include your analytical QC samples. So a lot of these, so some of these are field QC samples, so that's more relevant to this presentation now. So for example, make sure you include your field duplicate. I spoke about this earlier for your equipment blanks. So again, do a final rinse of your sampling equipment. And this allows you to evaluate the potential contribution of PFAS from equipment. Also your source water blank. Again, just testing your potable water that's used during decontamination. Okay, so to wrap things up, I talked a lot about sampling materials and selecting your sampling materials. So again, would urge you to consider a scientifically informed approach for selection of those materials. Again, based on the probability of direct contact with your sample, as well as the relative PFAS concentrations within those materials. Also follow media-specific sampling recommendations to collect representative samples. So that's the section with all the media-specific considerations. Also important to consider PFAS background levels. Again, given the low parts per trillion screening action levels and various other regulatory levels, it's important that we consider PFAS background since those may have an impact on our final project decisions. And in terms of the analytical portion, ensure to follow field sampling and sample shipping slash storage protocols. Again, this is going to be specific for the analytical method that you select. I guess the last thing that I wanted to mention, again, just be sure to check with your federal and state agency to see if they have any specific sampling guidelines and make sure you adhere to those. And of course, this presentation wasn't fully comprehensive. Again, I think we would need a couple of hours to go through all of everything PFAS related in terms of sampling. So again, be sure to reference those sampling guidelines that I provided in one of the initial slides. And with that, I'll take any questions. Also feel free to email me. My email's here if you have any questions, comments, concerns, or anything else. So thank you. And I'll take any questions now.
Thank you so much, Nikki. I think we've got time for a few comments or questions here before we let you go. So first off, someone asked if if there are considerations for sampling non-typical media such as concrete, for example.
Yes, so actually here at NAFEC X, we have a few projects going on that are looking at concrete or leaching of PFAS from concrete. I don't know the specifics of the analytical methods of that, but if you send me an email, I could connect you with John Cornuck. He's been doing a lot of work on concrete, so could definitely put you two in contact. I think he has two projects going on about that. So.
Excellent, thank you. And I've got a handful of other questions here. I'm not sure if we'll have time to get all of them, but folks, you're welcome to go ahead and type your questions into the chat, and we'll provide any additional questions that we don't get to Nikki and for other speakers as well. And if your name is included in there, then we'll be able to let them get back to you. So let's see, next up. So we have one participant asking, do you know why a standard reference material was recommended for biota but not for other matrices?
That's actually a good question. I don't know the exact specifics of that, but that has been what has been recommended within Navy. But I can actually look into that and get back to you to provide some further information on that.
Okay, great. So, Mike, if you can just keep that question open-ended for us, that would be great. And we can get back to the participant. Let's see. So, there is a question asking, could concrete or bentonite be a continuing source in the sample well?
Yes. So often it's said if you have kind of older well construction that you're using that have used bentonite or potentially some concrete formulations that contain those tracker those crack resistant formulations. If you're getting consistent low levels of PFAS within those wells, then it could be that is actually coming from the bentonite. However, we found that it's actually really hard to prove this. But if you know that your wells use coated bentonite formulations, then it's highly possible that if you're getting kind of those low detections throughout a cluster of wells that were built around the same time, that could be a potential source. But again, it's quite difficult to get the data to actually concretely support this claim.
Thank you. Okay, next up, can you elaborate, talk a little more about the recent QSM 6.0 requirement for sampling and analysis?
So I'm not quite familiar with the analytical specifics of that.
It's possible our other presenters may be, so maybe we
Yes.
can save that question for them.
Yeah, that might be more suitable for the analytical chemists that are coming up next. I'm
Yeah.
just a
All right.
toxicologist.
No worries. Okay, we can save that one for a little later. Let me see. Is there information available that you're aware of that would include background PFAS concentrations in shallow groundwater at a regional scale? Like, for example, this person asked about if California has such data.
Not that I've come across, definitely not from like I haven't seen anything from like a state or federal level, in terms of background PFAS concentrations. But like I mentioned, within the literature, there's been quite a number of studies coming out on background levels. So I would suggest checking into the literature, and also in on my slides, I have the references posted here, so you can look into some of these articles that I have here. I'm not sure specifically if California has been included in these studies. I would assume they would be, but definitely a lot of articles in the literature coming out. Just not that I'm aware of from like a state's entity or anything of that nature. Again, I feel like this the issue of background is really only getting more attention in the past few years. So hopefully, moving forward, we get some a better idea of, the background concentrations that we're seeing on regional scales.
Great, thank you, Nikki. Let's see, just a couple more quick ones, and then I think we'll let you off the hook. Someone asked about passive samplers that you spoke about earlier. Did you have any more information about those? I'm not sure exactly where in your talk they were.
Yes. So, yeah, see, the question is, where did you say that passive samplers are coming from? So these are mostly commercially available. So I think right now there are three that are commercially available. So I think if you put into Google, PFAS passive samplers, those should come up. And there are some ESTCP projects that are working on these. So I'll just go back quickly here. So on this slide, so ESTCP project, you have the project number here. So if you just Google this ESTCP project number, it'll bring you to the project's website, and you can get some more specific technical information on those.
Excellent, thank you. And just this last question, someone asked if it would be okay to contact you via email about some additional reading materials on some of these specific topics.
Yes, of course. If there's anything on here that you would like more information on, feel free to send me an email. Or if you want any of the reading materials, I'm happy to send anything over. And if I didn't get to your questions, just feel free to email me and I'll get back to you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for joining us and for providing this presentation for us again today. So with that, I'll let you go, Nikki, and we'll transfer over to our other speakers.
Sounds good. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay,
And then
so,
let me remind I'm sorry to interrupt. Let me remind all of our attendees, you do not need to wait until the Q&A time to send in your question. Just go to the bottom of the screen, click on the Q&A button. It'll bring up the box and you can ask your question at any time. But we will only answer it at the end of this block of presentations by the EPA. Thanks.
thank you, Mike. Okay, first, I'd like to introduce our next pair of speakers, and then I'll hand it over. So first up, we'll have Becca Burkett. She is a recent addition to our methods team in the Engineering and Analysis Division of OST within EPA's Office of Water. And prior to working with EPA, she researched bioaccumulation of contaminants of emerging concern as part of her PhD work at Baylor University. She's our newest chemist on the methods team and is working on developing PFAS methods for wastewater and currently leading the development effort for an adsorbable organic fluorine method. So welcome, Becca. And another person from Becca's team here, Adrian Hanley, will be available for us to ask questions after this talk. And the second portion of the talk will be given by Troy Strzok. He's the organic methods lead for SW846 methods program in EPA's Office of Resource Conservation and Recovery, or ORCR. And prior to joining ORCR, he spent 2 years in the cubicle across from me over in the contract laboratory program in our Superfund office here at EPA. And he also spent 14 years at EPA's Region 5 laboratory in Chicago as an organic chemist. So welcome, Troy and Becca and Adrian. And Becca, I will hand it over to you now. And I see your slides. Thank you.
Okay, good. Adrian is actually our team lead for the Clean Water Act Methods Program. So he's joining us today. He couldn't attend back in November for the first round of this talk. So I covered both the PFAS methods, but he is a project lead for Method 1633, and I am for Method 1621. So we'll kind of tag team this presentation today, and then we're both here for questions. I can do probably the intro slides, and then I'll hand it over to Adrian.
Sounds good, Becca.
Okay. So here's our disclaimer. Views expressed in this presentation are those of the authors and do not necessarily represent the views or policy of the agency. First off, we're sharing this slide just about the different EPA offices that publish analytical methods, because there are a lot of us. And so, Office of Air and Radiation, that's where we're going to house Clean Air Act at the Office of Air Quality Planning and Standards, with stationary source methods and ambient air methods. And Office of Water, that's where we live, Office of Science and Technology with Clean Water Act methods. And then many of you are familiar with our drinking water methods from the Office of Groundwater and Drinking Water through the Safe Drinking Water Act. OLEM, so Office of Land and Emergency Management, that is Troy's house. Office of Resource Conservation and Recovery, Resource Conservation and Recovery Act methods, so RCRA. And other important sources of methods in the EPA, all of our ORD labs, the EPA regional labs, and the Office of Chemical Safety and Pollution Prevention. So all of these methods that we publish and put on the website have a lot of overlapping terms, approved, final, promulgated, all of these things. And so to sort of streamline a document so that somebody could reference and figure out what do all these different terms mean from all these different programs. We had an effort in July 2023 to publish this terms used to describe the standing of US EPA methods. So this link is here. It's a pretty long document, and so I don't expect everyone to rush off and go read it now, but it's a good thing to bookmark if you're ever questioning, well, what does final mean for this office compared to this other office? We've got all sorts of definitions in that document broken down by each one of these offices that makes methods. So with that, I'll transfer it over to Adrian so he can talk about the Clean Water Act methods program.
Thank you, Becca. Clean Water Act analytical methods, when you think of them, it's for the most part wastewater, sort of what's coming out of that pipe and what's in it. The majority of our work is for Clean Water Act NPDES permits, but we also do a fair amount of related work. We seem to be the default methods people use for surface water, many of our methods have sections on sediment and biosolids also, because they're awfully related to wastewater. Our methods range from chemical methods to physical properties to biological methods to whole effluent toxicity methods. It's hundreds of different methods are in our program. We unlike most EPA programs, except for drinking water, have we validate our methods, we finalize our methods, but then if we want someone to have to use them in a NPDES permit, we put them through rulemaking and it has to go through public comment. And then, assuming it makes it through public comment, it then becomes promulgated and added to EPA's, the Code of Federal Regulations, 40 CFR Part 136. And once it's there, you basically have to use that method if you're using it in a NPDES permit or another of the approved methods listed in that regulation. Next slide, please. So here is all of the Clean Water Act methods team folks. Kevin Tingley is our branch chief and our formal manager. I'm the team leader and I'm a chemist by trade. Lemuel Walker is our national ATP coordinator and is also a chemist. Becca Burkett is also a chemist and she's leading Method 1621 right now. We have Tracy Bone, who is our lead microbiologist, and Megan Hessenauer, who's a biologist by trade that leads all of our whole effluent toxicity methods. Next slide, please. So we kind of have, we have to do these things called method update rules to put our methods in 40 CFR Part 136. We have two flavors of them. We have routine methods update rules, which is what I or what I consider like housekeeping. These basically are what we consider non-controversial items. It's mostly alternate test procedures, so there's already a method for that contaminant, and this is just adding some options. It's editorial updates and revisions to EPA and voluntary consensus standard body methods that are mainly editorial in nature. Usually every time we do one of these, we've got several dozen ASTM and standard methods that have revisions. And then our non-routine method update rules or full method update rules contain the more controversial items. And I'll get into our next one in the next few slides. Next slide, please. So our 2023 was our last routine methods update rule. It was proposed in February 21. We had some updated language for our microbiological methods. We had 7 ASTM method revisions, 39 standard method revisions, 5 new standard methods. You say, hey, that sounds controversial, but it wasn't because they were very, very similar to some already approved methods. And we had 2 alternate test procedures for dioxins and furans. Essentially, it basically was it's similar to EPA method 1613B by high resolution mass spectroscopy, but instead you could use GC-MS/MS. And the 2 ATPs were very similar, but different vendors were involved in the 2 different ATPs. Next slide, please. So coming up this year is going to be our next what we call full methods update rule, or things that are somewhat controversial. We haven't 100% finalized what's going to be in this rulemaking, but we are going to try and get it out the door by the end of 2024, which some people told me is overly optimistic. It will certainly contain our PFAS method 1633 for the 40 PFAS analytes and method 1621 for absorbable organic fluorine. I am hoping and guessing there will be several other methods in there. I'm really hoping to get our 1628 PCB conjugate method in there. And we will soon be contacting our voluntary consensus standard bodies to see if they have any new methods that they would like to add. I do have to say that, anyone who wants to add a method to this next methods update rule would need to provide multi-laboratory data and a multi-laboratory validation study report. Next slide, please. So, method 1633. It was originally based on an SOP from SGS Access in Canada. This project started out with the Department of Defense approaching us and saying, look, we really want to have an EPA method that we can use. We're willing to work with you and go through your validation process, and we'll manage the project and essentially pay for everything. Now, the Department of Defense also wanted to have, soil in the method and a lot of, matrices that we don't normally include, like soil and groundwater. So, we asked Troy from the Office of Land and Emergency Management to basically sit in on a lot of the meetings and review a lot of the portions of the method. And the goal here was to basically make an EPA Office of Water method, which we did, method 1633, and then provide the Office of Land and Emergency Management with all of the multi-lab data, which they could then use to make a very similar SW846 method. Next slide, please. So I'm not going to go through this whole slide because we really don't have time. But it's really essentially a solid phase extraction isotope dilution method analyzed by liquid chromatography and tandem mass spectroscopy. It's the good news about these PFAS is they're pretty stable, so they don't have any crazy holding times. The aqueous portion of the analysis does have some limitations depending on your total suspended solids. If you want to look at this slide for a little while, you can sort of get a taste of the basic steps of the methodology for our main matrices of aqueous, solid matrices, and fish tissue. One of the nice things about this method is that it did multi-laboratory validate 8 different matrices. So it looks at wastewater, surface water, groundwater, landfill leachate, biosolids, soil, sediment, and fish tissue. Next slide, please. So, the final method and multi-laboratory validation study report was posted on the web on our website here on January 31st, 2024. The multi-laboratory validation study report is also posted on a DoD website that I don't have handy at the moment because they wrote the report. We had previously, around July timeframe, made draft 4 of the method, which was finalized for the aqueous matrices of wastewater, surface water, and groundwater. Our multi-lab study had 10 participant labs, a referee lab, data validators and statisticians. It had something like 17 different entities involved in it. It was a tremendous effort. This is the largest multi-laboratory validation study I am aware of for any environmental method that's ever been validated. The report was so large, we had to split it up into four different volumes. If you're ever having trouble, difficulty sleeping, I strongly encourage you to try and read the entire 1,000 or so pages. Next slide, please. I'm just going to run through some quick results of the multi-lab study report. For the method detection limit, it was really interesting, and I did not expect this. The MDLB, or the MDL based off of the blank detects, really wasn't an issue in this method, and I did not expect that. We did not have a whole lot of blank detects. You know, some of the analytes for a few of the labs did have an MDL, a method detection limit, based off of the blanks, but the vast majority of our method detection limits came from the spike values. If you looked at the pooled method detection limit, which is basically we take the MDLs from all the labs and sort of, you know, make a pooled detection limit that we feel most labs should be able to meet. You know, most of our aqueous method detection limits were below 1 nanogram per liter, with a few exceptions. Our leachate method detection limits are basically 10 times, ooh, I got that wrong, 5 times higher than the aqueous ones. We didn't do an MDL study, but the sample size is 1/5. Soil MDLs, most of them were below 0.2 nanograms per gram, or parts per billion. And then, you know, our sort of troublesome analytes had the highest method detection limits. Pooled MDLs were 5.3 FCTCA, 7.3 and 7.3 FTCA. There's a mistake on this slide. The biosolid MDLs are basically assumed to be 10 times higher because you use 10 times less sample. For the tissues, most of the method detection limits were below 0.4 parts per billion. And we had our sort of troublesome analytes were NETFOS, 7.3 FTCA, and 5.3 FTCA. Next slide, please. Our ongoing precision recovery and low level, ongoing precision recovery, or for those of you who are more familiar with other terminologies, or laboratory control samples, were really good throughout the entire study. I mean, for the solid samples, we used Ottawa sand or something else that was similar. And for the tissues, you know, instead of using water, we used usually chicken breast, or a couple labs were able to acquire PFAS-free fish tissue, which is hard to find. You know, we didn't make any criteria more stringent than 70 to 130%. But the performance of these ongoing precision recoveries was so great. One was so good that a lot of them, if you had used the statistics, you would have gotten more stringent values than 70 to 130%. And the vast majority of our analytes were able to meet a 50 to 150% criteria. So, you know, I thought this was a good sign that, to show that the reference matrices worked really well with spikes and had, you know, fairly accurate data. Next slide, please. This method has 24 extracted internal standards. Most of them are carbon 13. Some of them are deuterated, and one of you know, we did notice that the deuterated extracted internal standards definitely don't perform quite as well as carbon 13. If you look closely at the method, we added flexibility so that as other analytes have isotope dilution standards, you can use them, because obviously we have 40 analytes and we have 24 extracted internal standards. What's interesting is the analytes that didn't have a perfect match for their isotope dilution standards quantitatively were about the same. So, you know, using a very similar isotope dilution standard or extracted internal standard to the analyte seemed to work just fine. We made one set of extracted internal standards based off of the performance of the matrix samples. We didn't really look at the reference matrices a whole lot because we figured that was a best case scenario. And most of our criteria were used from just compiling all the data and using a non-parametric approach, like taking all the data from all the lab, labs and sort of eliminating the bottom 1% and the top 1%. So if you are a statistician, I believe that's called the P1 and P99. And those values were, for the most part, used for our criteria. We did not make any criteria more stringent than 40 to 130%. And some of the extracted internal standards behaved actually significantly better than that. I'm just going to talk about the aqueous extracted internal standards. You know, here were sort of our troublemakers. We had 15 of the 24 extracted internal standards had 40% or greater for the lower limits. Now you can see these next ones in the fourth bullet. You know, some of these analytes had some lower recoveries for their criteria, and obviously our sort of biggest troublemaker was, the carbon 13 PFBA, which has a 5% criteria. But what was really interesting is that when you looked at all the matrix spikes, the quantification was really good, even for the analytes where their isotope dilution standard was rather low. Our upper aqueous limits for the extracted internal standards, 17 of the 24 were at 130%. And then we had a few more at 135%, which is also fantastic. And then we had a few ones that just had a tendency to go high. And you'll notice that one of them was a deuterated isotope dilution standards. And then the FTSs, those ones just were really high almost every time. The good news is even though they were high, the quantification of the analytes still came out excellent. So that was the good news. And the trends for the other matrices were pretty similar. As you see here for the aqueous limits for the extracted internal standards. So I didn't want to be repetitive. I just sort of just wanted to look at one matrix. Fish tissue was by far our most challenging matrix in terms of quantification. But that's really not surprising. Fish tissue and biosolids are both really hard matrices to analyze. Next slide, please. So the next several slides, we're just going to run through them really quickly, are basically a nice graphic of all 40 analytes, what was the low spike and high spike, average and bias. And you can see here for groundwater, surface water, and wastewater, 30%, accuracy was pretty much easily achievable for almost all the labs. Some of the labs are out around 40%. But, really considering that this is 40 analytes and it's including the bad actors of those 40 analytes, overall, this is really excellent precision and accuracy. Next slide, please. This is the exact same diagram for soil and sediment. It's interesting to note that, soil was really tight. Sediment, two labs in particular had some problems, but the majority of the labs, did very well. Next slide, please. Landfill leachate, it's a challenging matrix, but here again, most of the labs did quite well. I call this the miracle of isotope dilution. I was really happy with these results. Obviously, you can tell you have one lab there that didn't do quite as well as all the others. But generally, even the worst performing lab is still achieving, 30%, less than 30% bias the vast majority of the time on all 40 analytes. That's excellent, in my opinion. Next slide, please. Biosolids was a tough one. We just had one outlier lab that really didn't do so well. But if you took that lab out, you'll notice that most of the labs hit, 30% bias the vast majority of the time. Unfortunately, I think that one lab, if you took their data, they may have been outside of the QC requirements that we made for biosolids for several of their analytes. But overall, I was really happy with the biosolids results. Biosolids is, one of the most challenging matrices that we analyze in the environmental industry. Next slide, please. And then fish tissue, of course, probably the hardest one to analyze. Here again, we had one lab that didn't do great and another lab that was a little bit off the beaten track, but most of the other labs did really well. I mean, you can see that one lab there pretty much hit the bullseye. But fish tissue is tough. It's hard to analyze. And I'm hoping that the one or two labs that didn't do as well kind of get better at this. But overall, 50 to 150% error is not unexpected with fish tissue, and I was pretty happy with the results. Next slide, please. So now I'm going to turn it over to Becca Burkett, who was our lead for method 1621.
Okay, thanks, Adrian. So 1621 is just a single analyte method. So I don't think it will take as long to get through these handful of slides. But as we have heard, everybody's kind of looking for PFAS methods. And in addition to targeted methods, there's increasing demand for aggregate methods, things like adsorbable organic fluorine. Naturally occurring organofluorines are rare. So for this effort where we were coming up with this kind of aggregate method, we collaborated with ASTM D19. They had a draft standard that was a pretty good starting place for us back in, I guess, early 2020. And we also worked with EPA ORD up in Cincinnati on our single laboratory validation of the AOF method. It was actually two labs who ended up participating in this single laboratory validation. So I'll share just some of the things we've run through, because unlike method 1633, we did encounter quite a few things with background contamination and things like that, that we kind of worked through in the single lab. So in general, for the method, the samples are prepared and passed through two GAT columns in series, and then you end up, combusting them and analyzing your fluoride concentration by CIC. This yields a single result that estimates an aggregate concentration of any organofluorine compounds in the sample. So that's our PFAS, but that's also going to include anything that has a fluorine on it. So you've got fluorinated pesticides and fluorinated pharmaceuticals that might also be in that sample. This method is a method-defined parameter. So, you've got to follow all of the steps as they are due to a lot of those things that we encountered during the single laboratory validation study. Like Adrian, I won't go through all these details. They're all in the final method as well. But, you pass through the cartridges, you have a wash step so that you can get off inorganic fluorine, and then you're ready to combust your columns. So we completed the single laboratory validation in April 2022. It took a lot of testing of different materials. We had to do quite a bit of tweaking with our calibration range and sorbent testing to find GAC cartridges that would be compatible with this method. I'm thinking back on it, I'm pretty sure every single batch we tested had some contamination. So then it became the question of finding the GAC with the lowest background contamination of fluoride. And so that's something to be aware of if you're running this method. You definitely want to test all of your materials, kind of like what Nikki pointed out, right? Anything that's coming in contact with the sample is something important for you to think about, and that's included in this type of method. We tested 36 individual PFAS, three different mixed PFAS standards, three fluorinated pharmaceuticals, and three fluorinated pesticides during the single laboratory study, and our recoveries range from about 40 to 200% for all of these analytes. There were some similarities to some of our 1633 data, where things like the shorter chain PFAS had lower recoveries. All of those details are available in the study report that's posted on our website. So from there, we moved on to our multi-laboratory validation study. And so this was recently completed at the end of January, which is the biggest update in this presentation since when we delivered it in November. We had 10 labs, 9 wastewaters and surface water matrices, and 3 spiking concentrations. So we did test a couple of different calibration ranges, including an extended range for higher concentrations. We used PFHXS for our spiking standard for this study. We also did PFBA and PFOS and one mixed standard. We did our IPR and method detection limit study. And then we also, with this method, since it uses the two cartridges, we calculated percent breakthrough for all of the samples that were analyzed. So our MDL for this method was 1.5 ppb. I should mention here that, like I mentioned, there was a lot of background contamination. So this method is a blank subtraction method because of that. But our pooled MDL was 1.5 ppb. And in general, the maximum was around 3 parts per billion for this method, which we think is pretty good for this type of aggregate method. We established acceptance limits of 80 to 120% for the mean IPR recovery with an RSD less than 20%. And we kept our 70 to 130% for the OPR. We had 429 matrix spike results during this study. 96 of the results had recoveries between 50 and 150%. Again, pretty good performance for an aggregate method. Only 3 of the spike samples had recoveries below 50%, and 1 was above 150%. The study report and the method are now both posted online. So if you want to get into the nitty-gritty of which compounds and which things, you can look at that study report. Generally, the shorter chain PFAS seem to have more breakthrough than any of the others, like C4s. But if you have other questions about that, we can follow up offline or even during this. I want to leave time at the end for questions. So please follow those links to look at the different PFAS methods. And with that, I'm going to transfer it over to Troy on the next slide.
Okay, yay. Hi, everybody. Thanks for staying with us. So I'm gonna talk briefly about SWA46 PFAS methods updates. Cindy did a nice job of introducing me. Please skip to the next slide for me. So the SWA46 compendium is published by the RCRA program, so the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act program. It is a collection of more than 200 test methods and some associated guidance for sample collection, quality assurance. Most of the methods that are published in the SWA46 are guidance. There's a few that are method-defined parameters. A few of these methods are incorporated by reference in the RCRA regulations, and they define, they are part of the definition of what is hazardous waste. Like, for example, the toxicity characteristic leaching procedure, you know, is waste sample is leached with the TCLP and the waste is above the toxicity characteristic regulatory limits and 40 CFR part 261.24, the waste is hazardous. So those methods are considered definitive and they are not flexible, are not allowed to be modified for the data to be considered definitive for evaluated compliance with the regulations. But most SW846, the large majority of those methods they're published as guidance. They're considered non-regulatory. Appropriate modifications are permitted to those methods, and other published reliable methods may be used for compliance with RCRA regulations, as long as the laboratory demonstrates they can generate data of appropriate quality for the intended application, and they can meet all the QC criteria that for their project that they're fine for their project, and so. The end of that, I think the most important thing to know about it is that for RCRA regulations, the regulated entity is responsible for ensuring that they're making the right decision. They're managing a waste as hazardous when it's hazardous, the methods that they're using are not giving them reliable information to make an accurate decision about managing their waste as hazardous or non-hazardous, then they're taking a risk. And so however they get there, however the methods that they're using can help inform that decision, but they're flexible, and so they're just responsible for making the right decision, and we try to provide flexibility in terms of how they get there, because it can, give them, it can lead to cost savings. It can make the laboratory work more efficient and so on. So the SW46 methods are used by also not just for RCRA applications, are also used for, they're used by the Superfund program. They're used by the Office of Emergency Management for removals. They're used for a number of applications, other applications used by state governments, by foreign governments, so on, for their, to generate data to make risk management decisions. So please go ahead and skip to the next. So for PFAS methods, I really have three categories of projects for SW846. That's includes the targeted analytical methods, some class-based methods and aqueous leaching methods. And so for the targeted analytical methods, these are, you know, quantitative analysis of specific PFAS with defined structures that are, you know, based on a quantitative analysis with a certified reference material and so on. So they're really, you know, you're providing quality assured measurements for specific chemicals. And so, you know, we're some of the method development work we're doing is to expand the list of validated chemicals, expand the list of validated target analytes that are that the methods have been shown to work well for quantitative analysis, and also to expand the range of sample preparation and cleanup methods that they could use for you know, to generate the data they need for aqueous and solid sample matrices, especially for, you know, to solve challenging problems. We're trying to, like I said, maximize the amount of flexibility that the, you know, the EPA, the public have for, to generate the data that they need to, you know, to make risk management decisions. And so the class-based test methods, you know, those are the aggregate methods that Becca talked about briefly, you know, such as, you know, we have this world of PFAS that we're trying to get our arms around. And there's a lot of these PFAS precursors that we don't have certified reference materials for. And so with a aggregate method or a class-based method, you know, we can try to get a better handle on those PFAS that we don't have standards for, that we can't make quantitative measurements of. And so one example I'll talk about briefly is the total oxidizable precursors assay, or the TOP assay. And that is a way of trying to capture some of that mass of PFAS precursors that we can't measure with the targeted methods. And then I'll talk a little bit about aqueous leaching methods, which, you know, we can use to evaluate mobility in the environment, especially from a contaminated source area. We can use to better model fading transport, and we can use to evaluate or optimize immobilization strategies like in situ stabilization before it gets deployed in the field. So please skip to the next slide. Okay, so for SW846, the targeted analytical methods, you know, we published the methods 3512 and 8327 in July 2021. And the method 3512 is, you know, colloquially a direct inject sample preparation method. So it's basically aqueous samples diluted one-to-one with methanol, vortex, filtered, and then analyzed by LCM-SMS. And so so we published those methods in July 2021. Now we're looking to benefit from some validation studies have been completed recently. Adrian had mentioned the validation study for method 1633. I think he said they had 400,000 data points for that validation study. It's a huge amount of data. So we're looking to build on that validation study and as well as the validation study that ASTM International has worked on with, in collaboration with EPA Region 5 for ASTM D8421, and to use these validation studies as source information to update to publish SW846 methods updates, including updating methods 3512 and 8327 to include some additional target analytes and to include the isotope dilution calibration and as an option in 8327A. And also to publish some new sample preparation and cleanup methods, including the solid phase extraction with the wax sorbent for aqueous samples, equilibrium basic solvent extraction for solids, and graphitized carbon cleanup method for soil and water extracts. The other thing I didn't mention here was that, you know, we've talked to some different instrument manufacturers and also Office of Research and Development about additional PFAS extraction methods, particularly for solids. And I think these analytical methods are going to continue to evolve, and we're going to end up with data to support publication of additional sample preparation and cleanup methods for different matrices going forward. So this isn't the end of it. Here, please skip onto the next slide. So the oxidizable precursors assay, this is a method development project that ORCR is collaborating on with the Office of Research and Development. And I think this method may end up being useful for other EPA program offices too. We've talked to Office of Air Quality Planning and Standards and the Office of Science and Technology about this, getting involved in this method development project as well. But this original approach was based on a paper that was published by Hoots and Sedlak in 2012, and it's a warm alkaline persulfate oxidation pretreatment step that converts PFAS precursors to perfluoroalkyl acids, predominantly perfluorinated carboxylic acids, that we can measure with the targeted analytical methods. And so the benefits, so you see my little structure over here on the right, where you have this sort of long chain, this PFAS precursor with a fluorocarbon chain at the end, and it's got this big multifunctional organic group at the end of it. And when it goes through this warm alkaline persulfate oxidation step, we end up with a perfluorinated carboxylic acid that we can measure with the targeted analytical method, and we have certified reference materials for. And so some of the benefits of the TOP assay are that you retain some structural information, that was in the original precursor. And, you can use the same targeted analytical method for analysis. You could analyze the sample before it's oxidized and after it's oxidized, look at the mass of perfluoroalkyl acids in the sample prior to and after oxidation, and you can see, are you seeing an increase in the number, in the mass of the precursors that were in the sample, indicating that you have precursors there that you potentially can't measure. Without this oxidation step. And so some of the challenges that we have to address with this method development project are really to ensure we can maintain our oxidation efficiency, because you need a high redox potential to see this transformation of some, particularly of some recalcitrant PFAS precursors to the perfluoroalkyl acids. In a high organic content matrix, it can be challenging to maintain that oxidation efficiency because the organics can quench that reaction. There's other solids that can quench the reaction too, the oxidation reaction. And so, we may need some pretreatment to ensure we can maintain that oxidation efficiency in samples. And we also are proposing to use some labeled PFAS analogs, a precursor analog, to monitor oxidation efficiency so we can see transformation in the sample, in every single sample, and we can be sure that we maintained our oxidation efficiency and saw a conversion of the of at least a model precursor that was in the sample. So we're confident that we're efficiently oxidizing the precursors that are there. Another one of the challenges to address is trying to do a better job of capturing all the oxidative degradation products that we're making, including some of the short and ultra short chain PFAS, perfluoropropanoic acid and trifluoroacetic acid, which are they may not work as well with the targeted analytical methods that we have published, and they weren't validated. The perfluoropropanoic acid was validated in the ASTM D8421 validation study, but it's the salts in these samples, after this oxidation step is completed, the salts in there can cause some baseline problems. And so there's some issues to work out when it comes to quantitative analysis of the ultra short chain PFAS that I think we're making good progress on. And when it comes to, we're trying to minimize volatile loss here. So we're not losing volatile precursors or intermediate degradation products in the process of doing this oxidation. So we can get a good molar balance between the reactants and products. We're going to need some different approaches for the aqueous and solid samples, because the sorb fraction of PFAS precursors can be really, they can be difficult to extract. There are some precursors that may not extract very well with the like the analytical procedure, the way that it's laid out in method 1633, because the cationic PFAS may not come off of the soil very well with the basic methanol extraction. And so, so we have some challenges that we're working to address. We have a, really a great team of collaborators to work on, including the Office of Research and Development and some of the other EPA program offices and some universities and commercial labs. And so our goals are really to complete this development work in 2024 and then work on validating and publishing a standardized EPA method. Please skip to the next slide. Okay, so the next thing I want to talk about is the aqueous leaching methods for PFAS. And so the leaf methods we published for, validated and published for inorganics in, I think they were finalized in 2019. So there's a suite of four aqueous leaching methods that we validated and published for inorganics. And there are two batch equilibrium methods, 1313 and 1316. And then there's a upflow column percolation methods, method 1314, and a semi-dynamic tank leaching test, which is method 1315. And the these leaf methods are part of a part of this leaching environmental assessment framework, which includes the methods, a how-to guide and some case studies. That's really what we're trying to do here with these methods is identify the key variables that affect leaching behavior, get a better estimate of source term, which is the aqueous concentration in contact with the contaminated source material, or determine a release rate that we could use along with some site-specific conditions to better model fade and transport. And also, like I said, to evaluate or optimize the mobilization strategies, like a mix for concrete with the carbon in it, let's say, for in-situ stabilization, that can be very expensive to deploy in the field. And so you really want to be sure that it's going to work, you know, the first time. And so we end up, you know, using these, we could use these methods to optimize that, that immobilization, reagents mix, in a laboratory environment before it gets deployed in the field. And we're going to have better, odds of success once it's deployed. Please skip to the next slide. Okay, so the current status of these leaf methods for PFAS, you know, we started a multi-lab validation study for the first two methods, for the batch equilibrium methods, 1313 and 1316, for PFAS and for semi-volatile organics in January. And there we have, you know, four participating laboratories, and they're in the process of testing two different field contaminated soils. So we got them from, you know, a couple of different Superfund sites. We're using actual soils and not spike soils. The labs are in process of finishing the leaching, and we're sending all the samples to commercial laboratory for testing right now. And then the next method that we'll put through multi-lab validation is method 1314, which is the column test. And the method development work, I think, is pretty much complete for that method. And so a lot of the method development work was performed through a CERTIP grant, which was led by Jen Guelfo at Texas Tech, who was the PI, and David Costin and Andy Garibrants at Vanderbilt University. And so this really method development work was largely completed outside of EPA, but really in close coordination with the Office of Research and Development. And so that'll be the next phase of this validation study. And then they're still working on finishing development work for 1315A, which is the semi-dynamic tank leaching test. And that one is probably going to be the most useful for evaluating in-situ stabilization remedies. And so we have some other projects that we're working on with the for looking at PFAS leaching using these leaf methods. And one of those is leaching from biosolids. And that's a collaborative effort between the Office of Water and the Office of Land Emergency Management, Office of Research and Development. Anyway, this figure over here on the right hand side just shows some data from I think this is the 1316 study, where it's a batch equilibrium test at different liquid to solid ratios. And you can see these are for four different soils, just like how much, you know, it's, you see like in a, on a log scale, how these PFAS at this is PFOA, how the PFOA really pretty readily leaches out of these subsoil samples, you know, even at a liquid solid ratio of 10. Please skip to the next slide for me. So I also wanted to mention a handful of projects that other EPA program offices are working on. Becca mentioned the other EPA program offices in the first slide or the second slide. And so the Office of Groundwater and Drinking Water, they published the PFAS analytical methods 533 and 537.1 in 2018 and 2019. And so those are already final methods, and they're working on a couple of other method development projects, including a solvent dilution direct inject method for drinking water samples, and inline solid phase extraction method. Those are both LCMS MS based methods, and Will Adamson and the Office of Groundwater and Drinking Water is the lead for that. And then the next project I wanted to mention was extractable organic fluorine method, which Dan Tettenhorst in the Office of Research and Development is the lead for. And this is different from the method that Becca had mentioned, in that it's the front end is like method 533 or method 1633 for aqueous samples, where they're doing a wax solid phase extraction, and then they do a elution, and then they do combustion ion chromatography. And I think the reason is to try to reduce the background that they were seeing from the graphitized activated carbon, granular activated carbon that they're using for the adsorbable organic fluorine test. You know, that one part per billion, they were really looking for a lower background than that for the drinking water testing. And I heard Dan Hauptman say at a presentation a couple of weeks ago that they could get down to 50 or 70 parts per trillion, I think, for a background, or below that for a background for this extractable organic fluorine test, which is a little bit lower and maybe more appealing for the drinking water matrices. And then so Dan, like I said, Dan Tettenhorst is a contact for that one if you wanted more information. And then the Office of Air Quality Planning and Standards publishes stack sampling and analysis methods for stationary sources. For PFAS for OTM 45, that was released in January 2021, and I think they're working on revisions to it to expand the to make it more compatible with the method 1633, the labeled internal standards that are in there, and so on. And I'm not sure what kind of other process changes they might be making, but like Nikki mentioned, you know, OTM 50 is a volatile PFAS method in a SUMA canister. The samples are collected in SUMA canisters, and really both of these methods include sampling. So they include a sampling train and they have sample collection, and they have an analysis, sample preparation and analysis in the laboratory, together in the same method. And so for the OTM 50, you know, it's an air canister sampling method. And so they're using GCMS, for the analysis of the air canister samples. But they have, for the sampling train, they actually have to bubble the stack gas through water if they're worried about combustion of halogenated organics, because they end up generating acid gases that eat the inside of the canister. And so they bubble the gas through water, through these impingers with water in them, and then collect the gas in the canister at the end of the sampling train. And they're also working on a method development project, which is OTM 55, and that's for nonpolar longer chain PFAS, such as the fluorotelomer alcohols. And David Berkowitz is a great chemist. He works in the Office of Air Quality Planning and Standards, and Jeff Ryan and Stephen Jackson in the Office of Research and Development. These guys have been collaborating on these methods. So those would be the right people to ask more questions of. Please skip to the last slide for me. I think this is the last one. Yep. So here's our contact information for Adrian and Becca in the Clean Water Act Methods Program, and for me in the SWA 46 Methods Program. Just let us know if there's anything we can do for you. Thanks.
Okay, great. Thank you, Troy and Becca and Adrian. Now we've got a handful of questions that have come through for you here. So let's see. And folks, please keep writing your questions in if you have more. We've got a number of folks asking about costs for applying these methods. Are any of our presenters here aware of any project cost or estimation tools that are out there which might be useful, or can you speak to the differences in costs for analysis between, like, the comparison between 1633 and 1621? Anyone who wants to jump in.
Last I looked, it looked like 1633 was costing somewhere between $500 and $600. 1621, we were out of flexibility for the single burn, which would bring the price down significantly. Right now there's kind of a supply problem for that method, so it's been rather pricey. It's been around $500 or $600, but I expect it'll plateau out in the next year or two, amount around more like $300 or $400. The high price now is mainly due to the fact that there's just not enough labs running it. Now, if you want to do two burns with 1621, you'll probably still have to pay significantly more. When I say two burns, I mean burn each of the activated carbon cartridges separately.
Great, thank you. Any other information that the other speakers want to add on that topic?
I've seen excellent costs for the direct analysis of like 3512 and 8227 on the order of, you know, $200 to $300 a sample, I think. And the laboratories set, you know, for SW846, laboratories are responsible for establishing their own lower limits of quantitation. And so I've seen laboratories report down to concentrations as low as 2 parts per trillion with that method. And so it's possible to use that direct inject approach to get down to low nanogram per liter sensitivity. But whether that is acceptable is going to depend on your application. You know, like Nikki said, DoD says no screening okay, but for quantitative analysis they want to use method 1633. They consider it definitive. So for cost, you know, that sensitivity, your sensitivity need, and your per sample analysis cost might be an important consideration. And I always recommend consulting with the testing laboratory. You know, especially during project planning, I think it's a good time to consult with prospective laboratories to decide on, you know, can they meet your sensitivity needs? You know, you can ask questions about what kind of background problems they have. What kind of background do they see? What kind of blank contamination problems do they see? You know, what do they use for, what do they report for limits of quantitation? I think the method 1633 gives them some flexibility in reporting the, their limits of quantitation as well. And so, seems like, when you're in the process where you haven't paid them yet, or you're in the process of planning a project, that seems like a good time to ask questions to the laboratory and get good responses from them.
Great. Thanks for that extra info, Troy. Let's see. Next question. I think this might have been mentioned. Becca, you may have said this. Is method 1621 applicable for drinking water?
Thank you for the question. It's for aqueous matrices, but just like Troy mentioned, our method detection limit is, you know, around 1.5 parts per billion. And so there are efforts in the Office of Groundwater and Drinking Water to get a different method with a lower detection limit with that extractable organic fluorine method. We primarily developed this method for like a quick screen in wastewaters.
Got it. Okay. Thank you. While I've got you there, I've got another question on method 1621 MLV. Were there any reasons why fluorinated pharmaceuticals or pesticides were not included? As mentioned, the method covers non-PFAS fluorinated chemicals too, but the MLV was only done on PFAS.
Yeah, so because we have lots of data from those fluorinated pharmaceuticals and pesticides from the single laboratory validation study. So we, you know, basically consolidated our resources to focus on short-chain PFAS, long-chain PFAS, and a mixed PFAS standard so we could get as many of those types of compounds as possible. So we did have something like, you know, around 30 or 40 PFAS in the mixed PFAS standard.
Great, thank you. Now, is EPA working on a total oxidizable precursor assay method? And I don't know if that's a question for... No? Maybe we've got a slide on this.
One more? No, it's one more back. There you go.
I knew it was in here.
Yeah, sorry if I talked, you know, too monotone.
But yes, we are. So here's the slide from Troy and some other contact information or a paper you can link to.
Okay, my apologies. This question might have come in before we got to this slide now that I'm looking at the timestamp on it. Mm-hmm. So thank you for pointing back to that information. Let's see. Bear with me just a moment while I skim through these here. This participant asked, they said it probably depends on the specific lab's SOPs, but in general, how comparable are the results from a modified 537.1 to 1633 for different matrices?
Question, but it probably depends on what the modifications are. I've seen.
Okay.
I don't want to talk for Adrian or Becca, but I just was going to say I've seen data from laboratories that ran a modified 537 that actually looked very good. You know, I saw some things in their SOPs that were different than the way that method 1633 is written, such as, you know, they might dilute the extracts instead of rerunning the samples if the concentrations in the samples are very high. You know, so the, which is, you know, the method 1633 doesn't say, you know, you can dilute your extracts if the concentrations are very high. You end up, you can only have a limited range you can dilute the extracts in, and then you end up having to re-prepare the sample at a smaller amount, a smaller volume or mass. But otherwise, I would say largely the data I saw, at least for a couple of specific projects, the data were pretty good by method 537 modified.
I'd just add that if you're running 537 modified, you're basically running an in-house lab method. You know, you're not getting the consistency that of a method that's been multi-laboratory validated. You know, when you modify a drinking water method, that could mean anything. You're not allowed to modify a drinking water method. You know, when you see 537 modified or 533 modified, that just means you're using the in-house lab method that is loosely based off of the EPA method, or maybe it follows it closely, but you don't know.
Thank you. That's a great point. We've got a question about, and I apologize, this may have come again before Troy got through all of these upcoming methods. Was there work by EPA to develop a threshold value for adsorbable organic fluorine? Maybe a question for Troy.
I don't understand the question. Sorry. I mean,
okay,
a threshold value like a regulatory value or?
I think that's what they're asking.
So for wastewater, we have industry specific effluent guidelines. And I think that we'll certainly have one for PFAS manufacturers, which will be coming out in the next few years. And there's some other industries that are working on that'll have guidelines for, you know, permit limits for 1621. But that's about all I can say about that subject.
Okay.
If you're looking for a risk criteria, boy, that's tough. I mean, AOF is anything under the sun. It's an organic compound that has fluorine in it. So I don't see a risk criteria being published.
Okay, that's useful. Do you know if there are types of compounds or molecular structures in pharmaceuticals and pesticides that are likely to interfere with the AOF analysis for PFAS?
I'm thinking, I'm not sure if I'm interpreting interfere exactly the same way, but my brain went to are th that yes, there are fluorinated pharmaceuticals and pesticides. So with the AOF result, you get a value of fluoride. You know, in the end, you're getting a concentration of fluoride per, you know, your volume of water. You need to follow up with that method with a targeted method to get more information about the specific compounds that are there. And so that would be like running AOF as a companion method to things like 1633 or some of the other targeted methods. And certainly you could run, you know, some type of pesticide or pharmaceutical method as well to see what else is there.
I'd also add that most of the pharmaceuticals don't have a lot of fluorine in them. I mean, most of them have like a fluorinated methyl group. So you'd have to have a lot of the pharmaceutical in question for it to be making a big difference on the result. The
That's
pesticides, though,
true.
some of the pesticides are a bit more fluorinated. What really liked about AOF is that there are so few, and it's so rare to find a naturally occurring organic fluorine. So, your result is almost definitely being caused by something man-made, and none of the options are great. I mean, you're talking about PFAS compounds, fluorinated pesticides, or fluorinated pharmaceuticals. And given that it's a part per billion method, if you're seeing it by 1621, it's you've got fluorinated compounds there in a pretty good quantity. Remember, we're the wastewater part of EPA, so the main goal of this method was to make sure someone didn't have a whole bunch of fluorinated crud coming out of their effluent pipe.
Excellent. Thank you. And I see we're running out of time here, so I would like to thank our speakers for these presentations and also for answering these questions. And for folks who joined us and had these questions today, if we didn't get to you, please make sure to provide us with your contact information, or you can contact any of the speakers that were on today, or myself or Mike, and we'll help get you some answers. But again, some of these did come in anonymously, so we don't have a way to reach back out to you at the moment. So with that, I will pass it back over to Mike to close us out. But I want to say thanks again to our speakers, and thanks to our moderator, Mike Adam.
All right, I got a couple more things here. This slide, you can connect with us. You can sign up for our email newsletters such as TechDirect, Federal Contract Opportunities Update, and the Technology Innovation News Survey, and learn about events from various EPA offices. And additionally, events from the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, Superfund Research Program, and training and events from the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council. And of course, more from the Federal Remediation Technology Roundtable. Remind you again that today's slides will be available, and so will the links and other information. This is also where our feedback form is. And in the feedback form, if you fill it out, it'll allow you to print off a certificate. This is information here. And be sure to enter your email addresses are correctly. And with that, one last thank you. And thank you for joining us today.